Michelle Steinberg of Executive Intelligence Review, speaking to you today from The LaRouche Show, the weekly webcast brought to you every Saturday from 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time at www.larouchepub.com. Today is August 24th, and you're listening to a live webcast dialogue with Lyndon LaRouche, the American presidential candidate for the Democratic nomination in 2004. I'd like to welcome Lynn to the webcast. In the past week, Mr. LaRouche has spoken before the Institute for Sino-Strategic Studies in California. He addressed a seminar in Guadalajara, Mexico on the questions of economics and the unfolding strategic crisis. He addressed a cadre school of some 100 leaders of the National Youth Movement of the LaRouche Movement. And as we're here speaking today, across the United States, political circles are being shaken up. 5 million copies of the leaflet called The Electable LaRouche are hitting the streets. So let's immediately get to the point. Mr. LaRouche, what are you up to now?
All right, after Labor Day, we shall release a new phase of the campaign. This phase will be in response to the utter failure of President Bush to deal with reality in the so-called Waco conference, in which he attended briefly for on about four times, I understand. At the time that he was speaking in Waco, we had two crises were developing, which are of immediate significance, which require immediate action by him and by other elements of our government. First of all, we are losing our rail system, the last vestige of it. We are also in the process of crippling and virtually destroying our air traffic system. Now, if we understand the effect of this, that if you continue this process, you have the following things to consider. The breakdown in the economy, the private economy of the air traffic system, means that we must shift from the less economical routes, which are the short-term routes, to concentrate only on the longer-term routes, which are essential air travel. Short-term routes are not essential for air travel, quite the contrary. As a matter of fact, sometimes you have high-speed rail, say between New York City, Pennsylvania Station, and Washington Station. You could probably make the distance with high-speed rail in a shorter time than you could make it by using air. So it obviously is foolish to rely upon air travel between New York and Washington, D.C., when you should have rail traffic. Now, also more strategically, to get rail traffic would mean, and to eliminate these kinds of problems with air travel, we would have to restore a true interconnected transcontinental rail system, which means you could get to every principal center in the United States, whether freight or passenger, conveniently and efficiently by rail. This, of course, means improvements in rail over what we had before. But now we don't even have what we had before. The track is old. It's up to its last century vintage, early last century, probably 1926 approximately, with some slight repairs in some cases in between. If this were to occur, if you have a continued breakdown of the rail system, away from the idea of a transcontinental interconnected system, if you have an accompanying crisis in air travel, then the United States ceases to be an integrated nation. What are you going to do? Drive by Tin Lizzie from the East Coast to the West Coast? The United States is no longer efficiently connected. It is no longer a unified, efficient national economy. So therefore, these areas are one of the first areas the president must act upon in a Franklin Roosevelt fashion. First of all, for government intervention and regulation to defend and improve the national rail system as a high priority investment project. Number two, we must save the air traffic system. Both of these are essential parts of our national economic security. So he must do that. He should forget the nonsense that was babbled out at Waco and similar locations and get down to business. And the Congress must be pushed into doing this. But it must be done now, otherwise no nation. This has to be made a key issue of the coming elections, the November elections. Mm-hmm. It should be clear by election time for these state, Senate, and so forth solutions, that anyone who is not pushing for infrastructure is not working for in the national interest. Therefore, we have to have a weeding out of those members of Congress who, among their other faults, are not pushing for immediate restoration of rail service and defense of air traffic. Now, that's only the beginning, but those are two areas, integrated areas, on which the president must act immediately, now. And the testing time is the November election. Nobody should vote for anybody who is not for this. Otherwise, they're being silly. Okay, now that opens up a larger area. We are now in the greatest depression in more than 200 years. Mm-hmm. This means that we either have to make some fundamental changes away from the policies of the past 35 odd years, back to the policies of Roosevelt and the policies of the post-Roosevelt period from 1946 to 1964. We have to go back to that kind of economic system now, which means a regulated system, end privatization, end deregulation, end the funny monetary policies, all these things, get back to things that worked before, and do it immediately. The area which we can employ people, because we have many people who do not have the skills they had 35 years ago, the population had, therefore they are unemployable for many high-grade jobs. The way we handle it with Roosevelt, the way we have to handle it now, we have to take areas of primary need, the primary national need in infrastructure, where people with poorer skill levels can be efficiently employed in work which will be of national importance and national economic significance. That work, which is in the area of infrastructure, will create the basis for the expansion of the private sector in agriculture and industry. We must have policies with that goal. Now, this covers several areas, which should be the basic policy of the United States for the coming 2 years and longer, up to the run-up to the 2004 election. First of all, a national infrastructure policy. The air travel and rail represent aspects of the transportation sector of basic economic infrastructure, which is largely government-funded, government-controlled, government-regulated. You can have private sector in there, but they are regulated the way we used to do it. So air and rail are one of these areas. In transportation, we also have ports. We also have power and water, which are other areas of physical infrastructure which are necessary. We must end deregulation of power. We must have a policy of national support for a system of state-regulated utility systems, of utilities which have long-term investment with government backing and regulation for the generation and distribution of essential power. We must have a water system which is not only to supply our water needs for human and related consumption. We must have a water inland transport system, like the Mississippi River, other rivers. The cheapest way of moving freight, which is of low value per ton, and therefore is not high priority in terms of time of delivery. We depend upon that for grain, for ores, things of that sort. Inland waterways are ideal for that purpose, much more efficient than rail for that purpose. For sensitive high-value freight, rails are indispensable. For the highest sensitivity, yes, we require international and national air travel. In addition to that, we have soft infrastructure. Public health. We have destroyed public health since 1973, the HMO. We no longer have a public health system. We are now faced with the increment of diseases caused by economic conditions, caused by other conditions. We are not equipped to deal with disease, epidemic disease. Therefore, we must rebuild the health care system now. Forget this HMO, repeal HMO, go back to Hill-Burton. That worked, HMO does not work. Education. Today in universities, the price of tuition is in inverse proportion to the value of the education delivered. This is a scandal. Look at what's taught in universities. Frankly, it's garbage. And the students know it. They deeply resent it. Many of these students who are more intelligent of that student area realize that they have to go outside the university to get a competent education. The case of, I've been emphasizing the importance of Gauss's fundamental theorem of algebra, as presented in 1799 for the first time. That to understand this is an ABC of education. And I guarantee you that most college graduates today have no comprehension of the actual significance of that 1799 discovery on which the fundamentals of 19th century scientific achievement were based. So we need a revolution in education. Get away from the howdy-doody education. Get back to real teacher. Miss Marple is not our ideal for the educational system. And these are areas of national priority which the strength of our population, the maintenance of our economic potential in general depend. My campaign for this period will be a massive campaign on a larger scale than the recent campaign of the past month. Go up immediately after Labor Day, and it will continue with the target being the immediate November elections, to begin to weed out the chaff, to get rid of those politicians as much as possible who will not support urgent infrastructure rebuilding measures, and to go on from that to a deal with the larger issues.
Lynn, you hit on so many things that are on people's minds. I already have half a dozen emails on touching on some of the questions, but I'm going to take the prerogative to ask a question myself. At the same time as we're going to the countdown of November, most of the world is worrying about the wacko Texas summit from the standpoint of, are we going to be in a war by then?
It's a race. It's a race. We're now, as of Friday, and what happened on the markets on Friday are a reflection of the fact that the Plunge Protection Committee and similar kinds of people are beyond the point that they can continue to control the appearance of the market, financial markets. The market is disintegrating. This has been going on at an accelerating rate over the past 2 months. September is going to be a horror show on the international financial markets. It's going to be a horror show for bankruptcies throughout the United States. We're looking at mass layoffs with no return from them in sight, no recovery in sight. And therefore, that's the big pressure. Also, as a result of that, the United States does not have the economic basis for conducting a sustained war in the Middle East. It doesn't have it. Now, you've got people like former General Stokecroft and others who, I commend them, they've stated what they should say. This idea of Richard Pearl and similar idiots, this is dangerous. This is lunacy. We cannot have Ariel Sharon, an accredited fascist who's murdering people all over the Middle East, run U.S. foreign policy. Nor can we have his stooges in the United States, such Pearl and company, and this mole, Moraviec, running our national policy. We can't have it. We've got to have a sensible national security policy. And it's got to take into account our capabilities and our national economic security, first of all. We went through World War II. We were not the best fighters in the world. We didn't have the training. We scraped people off the streets and farms and gutters, and we put them into camps for 16 weeks in basic training, and we shipped them out with a little more training to become soldiers. They were not the best. Believe me. I know. All right. But we won the war. Why did we win the war? Because we had the most powerful logistical machine in the world, which Roosevelt built up during the period from 1933 to the course of the war. We were the most only power on this planet at the end of the war. This was based largely upon logistics, intelligent use of logistics, not killing. MacArthur was not a killer. He never fought a battle he didn't have to fight, but he won the war. And our policy on national security in every front is to achieve peace. You do not bring peace by war, by killing. You try to bring the conditions under which willingness to develop peace occurs. So the choice is now. Economics says we cannot launch a war without incurring a national disaster we can't control. We're in a position where we can launch a war, but we can't win it. We can do terrible damage, but we can't win it. This is insanity, strategic insanity. And you have a bunch of these civilians over there who think they're cowboys or Indians or something. Want to go on the war path. They're totally incompetent. They should be kicked out of government. They're a danger. They're a menace to public health. So the issue now is the president so brainwashed that he's determined to go ahead with a war in Iraq despite all the warnings, simply because he is an ego and the fact he's a very shallow thinker? Huh? Or are we going to have the sense to cut this nonsense out? And the economic issue, the financial crisis against the war issue is key.
In a moment, we're going to be going to our conference line where I understand we have about 100 people, organizers in the LaRouche movement, waiting, listening to this webcast and waiting with questions. But first, I want to go to a question from Africa. Lynn, what I have here is one of the questions that you've received in writing, because one of the most exciting things about your campaign is the website at LaRouche in 2004, particularly the Ask LaRouche section. And as I understand it, every week dozens, sometimes hundreds of questions come into you from the heart, where people really want to know how to get out of this crisis. This one comes from Africa, and I think it gives our listeners and our movement an idea of how important your campaign is. This writer says, from Nigeria, I believe, and she says, "May I request that we establish a constant and consistent communication, because I will always need your advice and moral support toward realizing my ambition of being a renowned economist like you. I'm in my first year in the university. I strongly believe that one day I must be opportune to meet with you and even work together with you, because you are one of my role models." Earlier, she talks about the conference Peace Through Development in Africa's Great Lakes region. And I think it's very similar to what you mentioned, that the nation state of the United States needs this infrastructure, this transcontinental railroad. Now, how is your presidency going to affect the rest of the world in that sense?
Well, first of all, we have to start with two areas. The Americas as such, because the security, including the economic security of sovereign states of the Americas, is the rock hard core of U.S. national security in all respects, economic and others. In other words, the stability and welfare of Mexico, Central America, Cuba included, the Bahamas, Dominican Republic, and the South America's nations. These nations are essential, their security is essential to the United States, as John Quincy Adams first articulated this concept. That's the first rock bottom. We must restore our relationship along the lines of Franklin Roosevelt, the tension of Kennedy had he lived. We must restore that now, and we must correct the errors that we have made, especially over the past 30 years in this area. We've got to eliminate the floating exchange rate monetary system and go back to a fixed exchange rate monetary system with a gold reserve basis like that we had before. Now, the gold will then be priced today at about $800 to $1,000 an ounce, but that's all right. We need a reserve system which enables us to have a fixed exchange rate. Without that, we cannot solve the problem of long-term investment in South and Central America, rebuilding imperiled nations of South and Central America. Now, the next place you turn to is Eurasia. Eurasia has two characteristics. You have, on the one side, you have the most densely populated or heavily populated nations of the world, India and China. Right. You have, in addition, Southeast Asia, you have Central Asia, North Asia, and West Asia. These areas are underdeveloped, some in the extreme, like Central Asia and North Asia, which are part of the Russia today, part of Kazakhstan and so forth. These areas contain, however, natural resources, large natural resources, these undeveloped areas, as the African Shield does. The African Shield is next to that. South America is a crucial, there's these kinds, same kinds of natural resources for development of future humanity. All right, now what we have to do is find a way to deal with the potential of Europe, which depends upon exports. The natural export market for Europe, potentially, including Russia, is South and East Asia. Right. So therefore, with the cooperation with Japan, which we hope would change its policy accordingly, we would have a policy of moving high technology from centers of high technology, such as Western Europe, Russia, Japan, India, and so forth, they have that also there, into areas which are deficient in terms of their technology, in order to transform backward areas and low productivity into high productivity and developed areas, and also to be able to develop and utilize the vast stores of natural resources which exist in these undeveloped areas. If we do that, We then have a general recovery in the Americas and in Eurasia. If we do that, then we can solve the problem of Africa. Because Africa cannot afford anything. Africa has been looted too long by the English-speaking nations in particular. And therefore, Africa must have a leg up, which means that the nations which can afford it must contribute to Africa the basis for developing a national or continental in basic economic infrastructural system, especially in mass transit, in water power, development of water resources, power, similar kinds of things, and a public health system which can deal with the disease problems in Africa, and then give them a start to be, by their participation in these kinds of programs, which we should support. Europe, Eurasia, we in the United States, and so on. This will give them the basis for conquering the problems of Africa themselves, and thus achieving their true independence and sovereignty.
Thank you, Lynn. Okay, we're going to go to our conference line. Are we ready with that question?
Mr. LaRouche, if you were elected president, would you regulate the price of oil or other commodities, and or would you leave it up to OPEC? And what about protective tariffs on foreign oil?
Well, I think that there's certain natural resources which are so essential universally that a fair price ought to be established, not quite as tightly as we established for gold, but a fair price level which we can agree upon, which the exporting nations and the importing nations can agree upon, and which is equitable to the exporting nations. Under those conditions, it's not the price itself that counts, it's the stability of the price and the kind of credit system we have. But yes, I would say certain natural resources which are essential to all humanity, which are abundant in some parts of the world and not in others, as a part of a new monetary system, a new financial system, we should reach agreements, parity agreements, on price ranges for these kinds of natural resources, of which petroleum is one.
Lynn, you said some pretty controversial things in your opening remarks, one of which is get rid of those people in the Congress that are a threat to this infrastructure. And for people who can see this, this is a third edition of a pamphlet, an EIR pamphlet. LaRouche says, to save the Republic, stop McCain and Lieberman. Well, this pertains to the Iraq War, but as we're looking into this, it also pertains to organized crime and the destruction of the U.S. economy with privatization, which is complete thievery. Just recently, McCain, I'm told by our economics desk director, Marcia Baker, that McCain has called for privatizing Amtrak, let it go, shut it down, sell it off. It's the last railroad in the United States. Same time you have an epidemic, it looks like an epidemic is shaping up of the West Nile fever from mosquitoes, all preventable. How are we going to get people, well, McCain I don't think is running this time, but what do you mean by getting these people out of office?
Well, first of all, McCain and Lieberman are of special significance. Not only are they owned lock, stock, and barrel by people such as Michael Steinhardt.
Oh, yes.
Michael Steinhardt, who represents those families which went from, as they described it themselves, from racketeering to riches to respectability. This is called the mega group in New York, which pretty much runs the United States and controls people like Richard Perle and similar scoundrels. Well, these gangsters, and they still have gangster practices, like the Empress operation in Arizona, which was set up by organized crime, as we have defined organized crime, not an allegation. This is organized crime. This is Meyer Lansky. This is the Bromfunds. It's organized crime. McCain is owned by organized crime. That is, his wealth came from marrying into an organized crime connection.
Oh.
Lieberman. Lieberman was elected with a real collection. You have this pseudo-Catholic, this Buckley, who, together with organized crime from Cuba, sitting in Florida, put him, the unlikely candidate, into the Congress in 1988, in the Senate. They're all tied into speculation against Indians. They all look at the Indian reservations and technicalities with special tax privileges, and they've used these for organized crime takeovers of these areas for organized gambling and other purposes. Arizona is virtually controlled by interests which are tied into this speculation against Indian lands, which spills over into Nevada, into Las Vegas. Mm-hmm. Connecticut, you have Indian tribes that don't exist, which are now running these kinds of gambling syndicates with the actual blessing of Lieberman, who says, on the one hand, I don't think about that, but he supports it. He receives his money from it. So you have, now the key thing, connection to all of these things, is Michael Steinhardt. I created quite a ruckus in this country in 1976 and 1980 with two campaigns against Carter. One in 1976 when I warned what Carter was going to be, not because of Carter, but because of Zbigniew Brzezinski and other people who controlled Carter. Again in 1970 and 1980, I warned of the effects of continuing the Carter policies, of deregulation, ruining the farms, and so forth. Well, I was right.
The Volcker interest rate.
Exactly. Well, I was part of it. Mm-hmm. So at that point, Michael Steinhardt, following that, from organized crime pedigree, his father was a fence, not the kind you paint, but the other kind. And he set up the Democratic Leadership Council. Now, the Democratic Leadership Council was set up in order to prevent my continued inroads into nomination for the presidency by the Democratic Party. Because I was recognized in 1980 as such a threat, and they had to go to such extraordinary measures to keep me from getting 25 or 30% of the New Hampshire primary vote, which would have put me on the scales. So they've been trying to get rid of me, and organized crime. So then you come to this question of the war in the Middle East. What are the forces behind the war in the Middle East? Who's going to war with Iraq? Well, the same people. Who are the leaders? Wolfowitz, McCain, Lieberman, Pearl. These thugs, all tied to organized crime, all tied to what is known as organized crime, the mega group which controls much of the Democratic Party policy as well as its influence on the Republicans. If we don't want war, we want recovery, we want freedom, get the gangsters out of government, get these two out, and you win.
You are listening to The LaRouche Show on Saturday, our regular weekly webcast show, but this time we have live with us for dialogue Mr. Lyndon LaRouche, who is, as usual, busting axioms. You can pick up the show. It's an archive, www.larouchepub.com. That's LaRouchePub.com. Mr. LaRouche has just told us about Lieberman and McCain, two candidates who are backed by organized crime. This story is documented in Executive Intelligence Review, the magazine, the weekly magazine that Mr. LaRouche founded in 1974. I would recommend that people get a copy of this report from EIR. It's for sale as a publication item not related to the campaign, and people can get it by calling 1-888-347-3258. The axioms are being busted all over the place, and we have about 100 organizers on the phone with us. And I just see, Lynn, from here that we got a call from Lagos, Nigeria. So we know that this call is being listened to from around the world, and we can look at the comments a little later. Right now we have Kenny from Minnesota. Is Kenny ready?
Yeah. Mr. LaRouche, what do you suppose the Russian response is going to be if we tangle with Iraq?
Well, the Russians and the Chinese and the Europeans and others are going to distance themselves from the United States greatly as long as this policy continues. You have to look at the overall reality, not just the Russian reaction. In England, there's a likelihood that Blair is going to be overturned as prime minister unless he drops the Iraq policy. We have on the continent of Europe, Germany has announced that it will not go to war or support a war against Iraq under these conditions. Italy is of a similar disposition. France is probably of a similar disposition. Russia's attitude is not different in essentially from that of most of Western Europe. the United States is virtually without allies except for Sharon's Israel on the Iraq war throughout the world. So what is going to happen if the United States decides to go to war with Iraq? The United States is going to find itself in serious trouble, isolated from the world politically, strategically, and with the greatest financial collapse in U.S. history coming down upon it at that time. Don't underestimate what's going to happen in the coming month, September, what is already happening now. This system is in a terminal phase of collapse. What we face is a crisis worse than that of the 1929-32 period. So this is going to be a decisive factor. The United States goes to war, it will lose the war, not necessarily at the first blow, but in terms of the unfolding of the consequences.
I'm going to read the summary of the question, Lynn, from Victor in Lagos, Nigeria. He called in as you were talking about the situation in Africa. Why is the State Department castigating Nigeria? Is it OPEC related? How is Nigeria being affected?
Well, first of all, Nigeria is significant as it's the traditionally the most influential nation in sub-Saharan Africa. Therefore, if you're going to destroy sub-Saharan Africa, you have to destroy Nigeria. And Nigeria, since the 1960s, has been repeatedly a target of these kinds of operations, especially over the course of the 1970s, coups and so forth, one thing after the other. Nigeria was, by massive effort from London in particular, to corruption, was prevented from developing its oil resources in a rational way. And it became a money operation, controlled by primarily British petroleum interests. But it's part of an Africa which is being looted. Africa is being destroyed. Look, the population of Africa, of the United States and Britain toward Africa, and clearly the United States, since Kissinger was the National Security Advisor, as attested by National Security Study Memorandum 200 issued in 1974. Kissinger argues that the natural resources of the world are intrinsically the property of the English-speaking financial powers, that therefore the people of these countries must not be allowed to increase their population, must not be allowed to exploit the technology, natural resources, because they will be using up natural resources which the English-speaking financial interests require for the future. Therefore, the population of Africa must be lowered, the sovereignty of the country must be destroyed, and you see what's happening now. You have mercenary gangs of former ex-soldiers by ex-intelligence service deployed, usually English-speaking, but some others, all over Africa, seizing, like Barrick Gold in Congo, seizing areas of resources, turning the adjoining areas into a wilderness of death, as is being done in the Great Lakes area. And this is the destiny of Africa under present policy, an intentional destruction of all of Africa. A similar policy is now aimed at all of Central and South America, including Mexico. That's the policy of Kissinger and company. That's a policy which has been carried out by the U.S. government, together with the British government, and with Israeli participation and other participation, since Kissinger and Brzezinski. That policy has been ongoing and has never been stopped. And that's what the problem is. If we can stop that and can reestablish the principle of the sovereignty of the nation state, then Nigeria could develop. Nigeria has the potential. It needs some assistance now after the damage that's been done to it, but it can develop, and it's one. Look, for example, just one thing, water. We have a tremendous amount of water in Congo, in the basin of the river, Congo River. We have an immense water shortage in Chad, in the vicinity of Lake Chad. We have large water resources which are poorly developed and managed in West Africa. If we develop a transportation system, as the French proposed back in the 1870s, from Djibouti to Dakar, a rail-based system. If we accompany that with power lines and water management, we can transform lots of Africa into a development area. Chad, of course, is a good example of a nation which is in terrible condition, but which does have potential under those conditions. So therefore, if we have these kinds of policies, or development policies, if we get rid of this evil, which is typified by Kissinger, typified by Brzezinski, those sorts of people, then Africa will have a chance. We in the United States and in Europe must support Africa in that. that Northern Africa as well as Sub-Saharan Africa. We must give Africa justice and its freedom at last.
In that regard, it seems like the State Department this past week, although it probably comes from the Fife and Bum Corps that we were talking about, that's the Defense Policy Board, for those who haven't read yet the Executive Intelligence Review. But it looks like that they have joined in the campaign to kick President Mugabe out of office in Zimbabwe.
Well, look, the philosophy of many, not only these clowns, but the philosophy of many in the United States is that of, well, you had organized crime, had a lawyer in Arizona. The lawyer, he's now the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. He has a crony who came out of the Justice Department, who's a little slyer than the Chief Justice, Antonin Scalia. And he is a real bum. He believes in what is called shareholder value. And that means that you have no rights, that property owners have all the rights. And their decisions will show that. So these are the kinds of the problems we face in this this area. And thus we can overcome these kinds of problems, we don't have much chance.
Okay, I think we have another question from Carlos in Los Angeles on our organizers' conference line. Is Carlos ready? Okay, we're going to go to...
Live in the dark age.
Carlos, can you start again?
How do you change your stuff? Not just to stop, but while something that keeps you blocked, permission to ask. How do you keep changing your stuff by other people?
Well, first of all, this is almost a religious question, but it's more than a religious question. It's also a question of constitutional law, as the United States, the preamble of the Constitution, defines constitutional law. What is man? Is man an animal? Or is man something special? The difference is that no animal is capable of willfully increasing its species' potential relative population density. That is, if mankind had been an ape with the qualities of an animal, the human population would never have exceeded, under conditions of the past 2 million years, would never have exceeded several million individuals. Today we have over 5 billion going on to 6 billion human beings. This is entirely the result of special powers of the human being to discover, transmit, and apply the discovery of universal physical principles by which we increase our power to master nature. Now, that the other aspect of that is we not only discover things as individuals, but we are able to transmit the experience of discovery from one generation to the next and throughout the contemporary population. Therefore, we as human beings have a peculiar kind of immortality, from the standpoint of the scientists. Our ability to discover universal physical principles, like gravitation, for example, discovered by Kepler originally, as reported in 1609, that this discovery can be transmitted as a re-experience to successive generations. By this transmission of culture, such discoveries in science or classical art, from one generation to the next, the human species and society generally is able to improve itself. And thus we live as a part of a process of self-improvement of the human species, or potentially that, if we continue at it. And in point of fact, we've made a great deal of progress, despite all the mistakes and terrible governments we've had. So humanity is, you're part of humanity. You're a part of the past, and you're part of the future. No animal is consciously a part of the past or the future of its species or life in general. Only man is that. Therefore, the corruption consists, in my view, essentially of ignoring that fact. As Christianity, Judaism, and Islam teach, man is made in the image of the creator of the universe and is empowered and able to increase his control in that universe. That is morality. That is truth. That is beauty. If we have those ideas, then we shall not be corrupt. It's the lack of those ideas which are the root of corruption. And it's the lack of those ideas in the present educational system, in the present culture, in the present entertainment culture, as well as the present educational programs of universities, which is what the essential source of the corruption which is pervading the United States.
You are listening to Lyndon LaRouche, the electable Lyndon LaRouche, presidential candidate for the Democratic nomination in 2004. I'm Michelle Steinberg with EIR, with you today on The LaRouche Show, August 24th, Saturday. Lynn, what you just said about this question of identity, I'll just tell the listeners, some 29 years ago, you wrote a piece called Beyond Psychoanalysis. And I was at one of the opening lectures on that, in which you discussed Percy Bysshe Shelley's In Defense of Poetry and the question of when our human minds reach the point that they can absorb profound ideas. One of the questions, like Carlos, comes from Dave, a National Center contact. He had asked you a question some time ago about the no future generation. And he sent a follow-up question. He says, it would seem that to the degree that one succeeds in thought, speech, and action towards the general welfare, one cannot avoid becoming a gadfly in the marketplace. My questions are, does it become necessary to become a gadfly? How does one survive and triumph as a gadfly against great and small forces that misunderstand, harass, discredit, and even arrest? How does one survive and triumph as a gadfly against the impulses to draw back from that?
Well, you don't try to get the idea of an individual Superman. There is no model for an individual Superman. That reality of achievement and power lies not in oneself. It emanates from a power within us, and the power to discover universal scientific principles, universal physical principles. That's a power that no animal has. That's a distinction of man from the animal. A classical artistic composition, as distinct from other forms of art, is an example of the same thing. But you don't achieve that as a individual, isolated individual, as a gadfly. You achieve that as Leonardo da Vinci did, by discovering a principle of painting, of plastic arts, and revolutionizing plastic arts. Now, how do we know Leonardo da Vinci? Because he was a gadfly? No, he was no gadfly. He left an imprint upon society, which is integral to all European culture to this day. Oh, that is all decent European culture of the present day. So it is our relationship to a social process based on those kinds of ideas which make us powerful. For example, as I'm sure the caller recognizes, when I was asked a question a couple of years ago about how can young people today get an education, since universities, which they pay for education, don't give one. They give them junk. They give them training and course in professions that are about to go extinct, like the telecom industry. So what do you want? I said, well, take Gauss. Take Gauss's 1799 Fundamental Theorem of Algebra, which contains within it, if you understand it, in that 1799 version, contains the essential distinction between at the blackboard mathematics, which is for dummies, and real science, which is based on physical principle. And Gauss shows that mathematics is nothing until you recognize it as it's a reflection of physical principles, as Plato emphasized earlier. So it's by communicating, as Plato describes this process in his various dialogues, such as the Theaetetus, which he raises the question of the doubling of the square, in the case of, or the case of the Meno, a similar kind of thing, in which even poor people, poorly educated children, it demonstrates the way in which even they can assimilate important ideas and even make original discoveries of great validity. It's by our communicating and collaborating with one another in the sharing of the development and application of ideas of this quality that we become truly human and truly powerful. That is why a couple thousand young people working with me are probably typify one of the most powerful political forces in North America.
We have now a email from the Philippines, the LaRouche Society in the Philippines. Mr. LaRouche, in countries such as ours, where a prolonged period of dependency has caused the existence of a government that's financially bankrupt, with its prime industries dismantled in favor of multinational corporations, its democratic politics slowly being hacked through legal maneuverings, actually this sounds like the United States as well, and manipulations by the active business sector's entrenchment in policy formulation. And a recent threat of having amendments to the Constitution to the effect of selling the nation's patrimony by allowing ownership of properties such as privatization. What are our peaceful options when the global blank blanks provide clout to our local blank blanks?
Well, what we're describing is what's being done to the United States by people like Mike McCain and Lieberman,
right.
And people who are like-minded or like-unminded, as in the case of McCain in particular. The answer lies not in individual national solutions. Each nation must come to a conception of its self-interest and its sovereignty, but its ability to resist and deal with powerful international forces depends upon partnership with a group of people who, in total, represent a strong partnership. For example, in proposing the development of a large infrastructure development in Eurasia, which essentially is from the Atlantic to the Pacific. It's not railroad. We have proposed essentially magnetic levitation systems, high speed from places like Rotterdam to Busan in South Korea, places like that. This would change Asia. Now, to get that kind of system in Asia, which it needs, would mean you'd have to have an agreement among Russia, China, and India, not as exclusive partners, but as keystone partners. The Koreas, the unification of the Koreas, the development of a railroad from Busan into China, into the Russian transcontinental system, up to Rotterdam and places like that, that would transform that continent. This then becomes a powerful force, not as a military force as such, but a powerful logistical force, because it represents a grouping of nations around a power block, which gives them mutual security. It gives them a regional security system and a regional economic security system above all. Now, what happened to the Philippines, especially from about 1980 on, was in the overthrow of Marcos by a coup run by people backed by Hank Greenberg, the American independent group in the United States. There was it was a business operation, formed a coup against the government, overthrew the government, put in a tyranny through a special forces type operation, which we observed closely on the scene, and the Philippines has never recovered from the effects of that coup against Marcos. It has no longer had independence. It's been deprived of that. So therefore, what is required is to create a coalition of forces in Asia, in Eurasia, hopefully with its support from an intelligent president of the United States, or a president with intelligent advisors, and not having an intelligent president. We would simply say it is our responsibility to restore the dignity and rights of the Philippines to itself, because the Philippines is a very special nation in our nation's history. We made a commitment to the Philippines, to its freedom and development and freedom. Therefore, we are obliged, rightly so, to honor that and put back what we made wrong.
You're listening to Lyndon LaRouche present some very heavy ideas. I'd like to go to our conference line in a moment, where I think we have some of the representatives of the student brigades in the National Student Movement on there, if they're not out organizing. I'm not sure at this point, because everybody, including the bottle washers, are out organizing for the outreach. One question that comes immediately to mind from what you just said. The United States is losing allies around the world. We face that all of the time. And right now, I'd like to welcome, I think, some listeners over in Oberwesel, Germany, where a conference is taking place. And I was told by our EIR collaborators that there's representatives from 16 nations, including the Middle East, Africa, Europe, the United States. We have a youth brigade working in the United States on the campaign of your wife, Helga Zepp-LaRouche. I guess the biggest question is, can we really expect to be able to change anything with this president, who just demonstrated how out to lunch he is at the WACO Texas Economic Forum.
Well, David Koresh wasn't there. It probably lowered the intellectual level. In any case, the yes, we can. Remember, the as in science, how do you discover a principle? You discover a principle, usually, the human mind, not because it wants to discover a principle, but because it's frightened into discovering a principle, or something similar. It finds a paradox in what it assumes to be true, a paradox which it finds threatening. All right, for example, the United States. Every idiot in the United States knows with absolute certainty that free trade is good for your health. Right? Now they discover they're idiots, that free trade is the worst thing you can have for your health, especially if you depend on health care. Yeah? So therefore they have faced with a paradox. They're taught to believe that free trade is good for their health. They're taught that privatization is good for their health, that globalization is good for their health. Yeah? It's not true. So there, and now they find the market, which they worshipped as God. This is our God, the market. The god of Delphi, the cult of Delphi. This is God, the market. Congressmen who are some otherwise sane individuals say, but what does the market say? What will the market say? They're crazy. But it comes to the point, what's happening to the market? Telecom is dead. There never was a recovery or never was net economic growth in the United States during the 1990s. That's a fact. But Clinton doesn't want to admit it, even now, because he was present while this was going on. So he doesn't want to admit it. It's not his style to admit that he might have made a mistake. He wants to blame George Bush. But George Bush hasn't got the mental skills to create a crisis. Don't blame him. It's not his fault. He's like Hoover. He inherited it from his predecessors, including his daddy, who made this mess. And before that, Volcker and Greenspan made this mess. All right. So we come to the point, the system doesn't work. And it is in crises of this type that suddenly the American people awaken, as they're awakening now, more and more, at a rapid rate, an explosive rate. How much money did you lose on the stock market? Ask people who were in the lower part of the upper 20% of family income brackets. Ask them, how much have you lost on the stock market? They'll turn away. They'll frown. They'll say, well, I lost a lot. None of your business. Right? Okay. Things like that. And everybody knows it. Layoffs are increasing. Plants are closing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's top executives are going to prison or threatened with going to prison. But there's not a top executive of any of these financial firms who was not part of a criminal system. So why are they putting these guys in prison that way? Why don't they just build a concentration camp and put all top financial executives in prison? Get the thing over with. Because they're all equally guilty. Also, the politicians are guilty. You have this Wendy and Phil Graham, Senator Phil Graham and his wife Wednesday, who are key for Enron. So you had a firm organized by a 2 gram brain. Huh? And this thing is tumbled. Other things of the same type of tumbling. Deregulation and privatization are failures. And people are being ruined. Do you realize that we are bankrupt as a nation? And the president is trying to cut taxes and doing nothing to increase income? Is that intelligent? No. It's times like this where people lose confidence in public opinion. And public opinion suddenly changes. And people recognize, first, not a solution, they recognize a paradox. This was supposed to have worked for us. We saved for this pension, and it's gone. Okay. We were fools. We invested in 401ks. We were warned not to do it. But we were greedy, and we invested in them. Now look what's happened to our pensions. Right? So suddenly the shock hits. The firms are closed. The country is going bankrupt. The stock markets are collapsing. All firms generally are crooked, all publicly held firms. Banks are going bankrupt. The talk is that J.P. Morgan Chase is going under. The Citigroup may go under, and so forth and so on. Banks all over the world are insolvent. The Japanese banking system is bankrupt. We're in a paradox. The great system over the past 35 years is disintegrating. And some people are still saying we must stick with the system. It's like saying I got to take a ride in the sewer system. Stick with the system. And under times like this, as we're seeing now, more and more people are changing at an accelerating rate in the population. I've seen this particularly in the past 2 months. The U.S. population is undergoing a radical change, rapidly. The youth are the most sensitive to it. The reason is that the youth know that they are a no-future generation, that their parents' generation, the baby boomer generation, condemn them to die in a no-future society. They have no education, no employment, no security. They know there's nothing out there ahead for them under this system. And therefore, the no-future generation, faced with the fact that the illusion has been an illusion, but the promises of a recovery, the promises of something better out of this are false, are now looking for answers. They want to survive. We face a situation which is roughly analogous in our national history to 1929, 1933, where the Hoovers of the world, such as George Bush, are saying the recovery is right around the corner, but there is no recovery. It's time for a Franklin Roosevelt. And the poor, the disenfranchised, the lost generation, what Franklin Roosevelt referred to as the forgotten man, and our forgotten youth of today, are saying we want a future. And the job of anyone who's serious about politics is to give the American people and the nation a future. It can be done, but they have to give up these crazy ideas. This is the character of history. Throughout history, nations really can't make fools of themselves. Some go down like Belshazzar in a great feast. Huh? We call the Waco Economic Conference, Belshazzar's Second Feast. Sometimes they recover. But they recover because the people are shocked by the fact that they discovered popular opinion was stupid. And they had reject popular opinion and look for better ideas. And they look for precedents in previous history which may suggest what these better ideas are. We're in such a period now.
Thank you, Lynn. You're listening to Lyndon LaRouche, presidential candidate, founder of Executive Intelligence Review, and as some Washington insiders have commented, come to my attention, Lyndon LaRouche is the front runner candidate, the most electable candidate in the Democratic Party. And right now, with this crisis before us, many among the population, especially young people in what was condemned to be the no future generation, is fighting for their future.